I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is something unsettling about our ability to track this past week's destruction through the internet, through the use of video links and wireless communication. It felt at times as if those of us in the developed world had a much better picture of what was going on in the disaster-hit areas than those living there. This year, at the start of 2005, we thought we would look a little more carefully at what links and what separates the parts of the world that are technologically developed from those that are not. Many people and many organizations are working to bridge these divides, and our series, Innovation That Matters, will introduce us to some of them. We're going to be talking this week about habitat, clean water, and lessons from the animal world. Today, we look at bringing light to places that have never had electricity. The Solar Electric Light Fund has already shown it can bring the tools of communication and medical research to the most remote parts of this planet. And so here's our question for this series. Now that we can do anything, what should we do? And what are the lessons we need to keep in mind as technology is taken to the furthest corners of the Earth? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I should just note that on our website at theconnection.org, you can look at a gallery of SELF's projects, that is the Solar Electric Light Fund's projects, and a link also to their website, and further to the Institute Without Boundaries, creators of the Massive Change book, which the people there have given us some assistance with this series. Joining us today from the NPR studios in Washington is Robert Freeling. He's executive director of the Solar Electric Light Fund, or SELF. Hi, Robert.
Good morning, Dick.
Thanks for coming in. It's nice to have you here at the beginning of the year. I'm wondering if you could just pick a spot, Bob, where you have been, where your organization have been. Give us a description of the sort of place that you would go and tell us what you take when you go there.
Well, our most recently completed project was in northern Nigeria. We electrified three villages in the state of Jigawa, which borders Niger in the north of the country. And we essentially provided power for a whole range of applications, including water pumping, vaccine refrigeration for the health clinic, the school, a microenterprise center, which is powering several businesses, street lighting, some homes, and a portable irrigation system.
Now, these are villages roughly what size?
They varied, but the average number of inhabitants was about 2,000 per village.
And they are largely desert locations or temperate, or what? How would you describe them?
These villages in Jigawa State actually border the Sahara Desert, so it is very dry and without much vegetation, and lack of water is a severe problem. Typically, women spend several hours each day going to fetch water of questionable quality.
Bob, the Solar Electric Light Fund's been around almost 15 years now. When you go into a village, such as the ones that you're describing, is it pretty well set up exactly what you need? Who needs to do the training? I mean, have you got that down to a science now?
Well, our projects are really driven from the bottom up. So we are, in all cases, requested by the locals to come in with support. And we, from the beginning, discuss with the local villagers what their needs are. And based on local needs assessment, then determine what are the applications that will be of most immediate benefit and long-term benefit to the villagers. So we really discuss things with them and decide what the priorities are.
How do they find out about you?
They find out about us through word of mouth, through the internet, through projects that have been done in the country or in other countries. In the old days, we used to receive requests in the mail, and we still do. But more and more, we're getting electronic inquiries almost on a daily basis from around the world.
I'm curious about how you guarantee or how you promise that it keeps on going. I'm thinking of the old sort of classic village water pump that was installed by Peace Corps people back 20 years ago. And as soon as one part broke, it was irreplaceable. The water pump was no longer used. Everybody was walking to the creek with their buckets again. How do you get past that with something like solar power?
Well, training and technical capacity building is an integral part of our approach to project design and implementation. So in each of our projects, we teach local villagers how to install and maintain these solar photovoltaic system so that when we leave the area, there are people that can continue to maintain and guarantee the operation of the system for many years to come.
You mentioned when you went through that sort of checklist of what can be provided, micro enterprise. Does that mean that there's someone in the village who's sort of given a form of ownership over the source of power and then gets to sell it? How does that work?
Well, basically, it's a generic term which refers to any sort of activity which can help generate income for the local people. In the case of Nigeria, we worked with the villagers to design a building which houses five or six small businesses and that are solar powered. And each of the businesses then are generating income for the local operators. So we see this as an increasingly important focus of our work going forward, finding ways to use solar energy for productive applications and income generation.
What would one of these village packages cost? Just right ballpark.
In the case of Nigeria, the applications, the hardware costs were about $45,000-$50,000.
And where does that money come from, Bob?
This project was funded by the U.S. Department of Energy and the U.S. Agency for International Development and co-financed by the Jigawa State Government.
And is the cost of these things, so your sort of major impediment in terms of however many other villages could get this kind of power set up?
It is. Solar photovoltaics is a very capital-intensive technology because you're essentially paying for 20, 25 years of electricity up front. There is no ongoing fuel cost. Maintenance costs are relatively low over the long term. But to install the system initially, there is a need to raise sufficient capital. And it is the high upfront cost and lack of financing which has impeded the large-scale dissemination of this technology in the developing world. In the past, we used microcredit as a primary tool to make solar home systems affordable to individual families in developing countries that couldn't afford to pay cash, but through some sort of payment scheme could afford to make installment payments over a period of several years.
I have to say I had rather a laugh at myself as I was going through the notes of the Solar Electric Light Fund last night, because I had imagined, you know, the assistance for irrigation, getting water to places that might not have it. I'd imagined, you know, setting up communication. What I hadn't thought about is putting a light in the school, having night classes, just the difference that it makes in towns that have no power to suddenly be able to do that kind of work in the evening.
True. Lighting is probably the very first application that people think of and request when we go into these villages, because after the sun goes down, people retreat into homes that are lit dimly, if at all, mm-hmm. by kerosene lamps, and everything is impeded. Just doing something as bringing a clean electric light into homes, into community centers, into schools and health clinics makes an important and dramatic difference in the quality of life in these communities.
I gather even streetlights have made a big difference in some of the places where you've been as well?
Absolutely. In Nigeria, we installed a number of streetlights in each of the villages, and it really increases the social cohesion of the community, increases security. People are able to gather under the streetlights at night and sell things and just socialize, which was not possible before.
And when we go to the kind of further high-tech end of what it is that you're offering, describe for me, if you can, this medical link that allows someone in the Amazon or someone in Nigeria to send medical information to a doctor or a clinic that can help the people there.
Well, this initiative was made possible by providing not just solar power to a remote part of the Amazon rainforest, but also wireless internet communications. I have been a strong believer for some time now in the opportunity to marry, if you will, solar electricity and wireless communications to deliver not just innovative energy solutions, but communication solutions as well. And in the case of Brazil, we used the satellite-based internet access to provide a telemedicine link to the University of South Alabama. And very simply put, we used a device called the Vitalink, which hooks up to people in the community and measures their blood pulse, their blood pressure, their blood oxygen level, their body temperature, and their EKG.
Just the little measure where you just stick your finger in a hole and that information then is transferred?
Right. All of that information is read digitally and transmitted via satellite to the University of South Alabama, where medical professionals were able to provide remote diagnosis to the people in the Amazon.
And is it complicated having someone in the Amazon who actually keeps that system going, keeps the link up, if you will, and is able to use the information once it comes back from the U.S.?
Well, our local partner there was a trained nurse, so he had quite a bit of knowledge himself about medical conditions, but was limited still in his ability to provide diagnosis. So this was just a way to augment his own knowledge and provide expertise where there might be a need for it. Telemedicine is certainly an area which has tremendous potential. The ability to deliver information and advice and medical services to remote parts of the world that are isolated and cut off.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Robert Freeling is with us this hour. He's executive director of the Solar Electric Light Fund, and he is one of those people featured in the book Massive Change. The question that is posed in the book Massive Change is, now that we can do anything, what should we do? And let's take the measure of technology as it moves in such rapid ways around the Earth. It's the first in our series, Innovation That Matters. We'd like to have you bringing your thoughts to this program. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. In the first of our series, Innovation That Matters, we're taking a look at setting up solar power in parts of the world that have no connection to the infrastructure, what that means for a sort of wireless world, and what are the lessons we need to keep in mind as technology is taken to the corners of the earth. Bob Freeling is at the leading edge of this. He's executive director of the Solar Electric Light Fund, and you can find a slideshow of the projects of SELF, or SELF, from all over the world on our website at theconnection.org. We're going to bring Medard Gabel in right now. He's CEO of Big Picture Consulting, joining us on the line from the Philadelphia area. Medard is author of Global Inc., an atlas of the multinational corporation, and has worked with a number of multinational corporations all over the world. Medard, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here.
I'm wondering, as you've listened to the work that Bob and his colleagues are doing, if there's a part of the big picture thinking in your mind that helps us understand how you get those kinds of ideas into kind of everyday reliable use, where they don't become pilot projects, but they become part of the way that the world works?
That's a great question. That's listening to Bob talk. It's a brilliant, important work that SELF is doing. And my concern with it, or the perspective that I would bring, is that we need to scale it up. It, besides just doing it in Nigeria, it needs to be scaled up so that the whole world that needs it can benefit from this fantastic work. And that's where multinationals and their resources, their financial resources, as well as the initiative, entrepreneurial resources, their trained staffs, et cetera, bring to the equation. Mm-hmm. If we can involve them at their scale, we can do a lot more than what we're currently doing with our friends in the NGO community, civil society, and government. We really need a tri-sector approach where we involve the governments, the civil society, and the resources of the multinational.
So at this point, what's missing? I mean, I'll turn to the back page of an average news magazine and see a full-page color ad for Shell Oil's solar project and how important they consider that to be. Something's missing in the connection between the kind of work that Bob Freeling is doing and Shell saying, that's exactly where we want to be as well. What is that something that's missing?
Well, One way of looking at it is that oftentimes that's where their effort ends up, on the back pages of mass circulation magazines. If you trace the origins of where that money is coming from that pays for that ad, it's in the public relations department. It's not a part of their core business. They're not doing it. Some, not necessarily Shell, but some other companies are doing it because it makes them look good.
Right.
And my point is that if we can set it up in the right way, they will be doing it because there are indeed, quote, profits to be made, not just public relations points, but you can market products that meet basic human needs to people at the base of the global economic pyramid, meaning the poorest people of the world, in ways that are both sustainable and profitable. It doesn't have to be just the top of the pyramid, the Bill Gates and down through the global middle class that benefits from this, what some people have called the most powerful engine yet developed for creating wealth, i.e. the multinational or the corporate enterprise.
Right.
And so one of the things to answer your question that's missing is that the corporations have got blinders on. They're only seeing the top of the pyramid where most of the money is. It's logical. And they've made a set of assumptions that are no longer true about the base of the pyramid. There are both needs that people have had at the base of the pyramid for ages, but there's also the wherewithal to purchase products that will meet those needs. It might not be the same business model that corporations are used to using, meaning, you know, you just put a product out there and somebody with a lot of money comes and buys it, but there are models that that will allow a company to sell large numbers of products. For example, in you know, the classic example is rural Bangladesh, where women who make, you know, less than a dollar a day are buying cell phones, and not out of the charity of Motorola, Nokia, and Ericsson, but full-price cell phones, along with solar rechargers, because there's no electricity in that part of the world, and stopwatches and training. And what they put all of four of those pieces together, they come up with a rural phone booth that provides a business for the woman. So she's making three to four times the amount of money somebody in that part of the world is making. So she and her family are better off.
Right.
And the community's better off because not only are they maintaining contact with sons that have moved to Malaysia or Saudi Arabia as laborers, but they're also buying, avoiding trips to the city to get seeds. And when harvest time comes and the person who used to show up every year in the past and offer 5 rupees per bushel for their bushel of rice, now they come and because there's telecommunications that links people to the city and other grain markets, they can point out that the price isn't 5 rupees, it's 55.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Can technology, in fact, solve problems that separate the developed world from the undeveloped world, or solve the problems within, help solve the problems within the undeveloped world? Let's go to back to Bob Freeling, who's executive director of the Solar Electric Light Fund. Just on this question of how you ramp it up, Bob, clearly it's something that you've spent a lot of thought on. Is it a matter of going to an investment bank in Brazil and saying you need to be here? Is it a matter of going to the Brazilian government and saying you're nuts if you're not here?
Well, I think it's really a combination. And as Medard so astutely pointed out, what we need is a tri-sector approach to this problem, where you have both governments at the national and local level, the civil society, NGOs locally and internationally, and the corporate sector all joining hands to come up with innovative solutions. And I'm really glad that Medard talked about the whole concept of using a private sector approach and the role that it can play in addressing the needs of the bottom of the pyramid. This is gaining more and more attention in this country and around the world. Just last month, I attended a conference in San Francisco sponsored by the World Resources Institute called Eradicating Poverty Through Profit. And this was a very well-attended conference, all looking at how the private sector can get involved in addressing the needs of the 2 or 3 billion people that lie at the bottom of the world's demographic pyramid. And we in the 90s self very clearly showed, using one very concrete example, of how to bring cost-effective solar lighting solutions to rural households. We demonstrated through a series of pilot projects around the world that if you give access to credit to these families who are already spending $5 or in some cases $10 a month on kerosene, candles, and dry cell batteries, if you provided access to credit to these families and provided a training and delivery infrastructure, that there is a very sizable number of families in the developing world that are willing and able to pay for solar electricity. And through these pilots, we demonstrated the ability of these families to afford solar lighting in their homes. And the end result was at the end of 97, we spun off a for-profit company, Selco, which is now installing these systems in India and Sri Lanka. They've installed, I think, up to 50,000 systems to date, and it's doing quite well. So this is a good example of how a private sector approach can be used to meet these needs.
1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you on this. We're going next to Boston, Massachusetts. Benjamin's on the line. Hi, Benjamin. What are you thinking?
Yeah, thank you. Let me first of all commend you for a very important program. I just came back from Nigeria on the 17th of December. And while I was going there, I took home about four solar lamps, which are designed for gardens or walkways, and tested them on a project that I have in Nigeria. And to my amazement, it also opened my eyes to the massive, intensive sunlight that we're getting in Africa. Yeah, 6:30 a.m. till 7 o'clock at night, you have massive sunlight. So it's a very good idea. So I mounted them, and they, you know, the light they were emitting was okay, you know, for a walkway. But on the other hand, I've researched into electrifying a whole building, maybe like a 10-room building. But I found out that the cost is what actually is driving me and many people away from it. It will cost over $10,000 to electrify a whole house. And again, depending on the size of the battery that you install on it, stores the energy that you're getting from the solar panel, and again, the size of the solar panel as well. So I don't know. My question is, how do we get down to cutting the cost? Because Nigeria, in particular, has a potential for individual consumption of this solar panel. As a matter of fact, people bombarded me with just these four solar lamps that I came home, which is an average of $20-$25 each.
Yeah.
They bombarded me, and they wanted something like that. And I even told them that there are chances that even if you want your whole building to be electrified, that they can do it. But it's just the cost that is driving me away. So my question.
Okay, Benjamin, hang with me for half a second. I'd like to hear what Bob has to say about, you know, what can be done in terms of bringing down the cost.
Well, technologically, there are some important developments underway to improve the efficiency and lower the manufacturing costs of solar cells. In fact, there are even new technologies, nano-based cells and organic solar cells that are on the horizon of being commercialized within the next few years. This new generation of solar cell technology has the potential of reducing the cost by a factor of four or five or perhaps even more, which will radically change the landscape of solar energy and its competitiveness with fossil fuels.
And in solar power for dummies, what are we talking about here? Not charging a bank of batteries, doing something different?
Well, that's another. Battery technology is also evolving. There are some battery technologies that are being developed which have the potential of reducing those costs as well. But for the time being, I think finance and providing access to credit is an important part of the solution because, as our friend from Nigeria pointed out, the upfront cost is still quite high. If you take a long-term approach and look at the life cycle cost of these solar systems, they become more competitive because once you have the system installed, there is no fuel cost. You won't have to pay anything to, in the case of Nigeria, NEPA, the National Electric Power Authority. But how to finance the cost up front is a challenge, and that's where access to innovative financing mechanisms can play a very important role.
And that's the bottom line, Benjamin, I guess, is even if the cost were half that, where's someone in Nigeria going to come up with $5,000 for their power system?
Yep. Well, this is Medard speaking. One of the possible ways is just a different business model. The way we're approaching it right now is this gentleman is saying, how am I going to pay for it? But what if the local utility was to install this, they would own it, and they would get the return on the person who was there would be paying a monthly fee. This goes back to the innovative financing scheme, but if we looked at different patterns of ownership and ways of getting money. We need to do as much thinking about the business models for these new technologies as we do for the actual technology itself.
Mm-hmm. Would that work, Benjamin?
It will work. Another thing I would like to point out, since you mentioned NEPA, which is the agency responsible for power supply, I found out also I researched into the reasons why our government are not putting any interest in solar energy technology. And then I found out that NEPA, that is responsible for supplying the electricity, is also responsible for importing generators. So they try to thwart every effort that will counter them from making money from importation of generators. So you still have all these bureaucracies to work that are working against you. Imagine NEPA responsible for importing generators, thereby making profit through them, through the company that supply them, preventing innovative technologies like solar-powered energy. So I don't know how you're going to get around that because of this massive corruption that is going on in Nigeria right now.
Well, I would like to share some potentially good news in Nigeria. Our project in Jigawa State was visited by no less than 12 governors. Governor Taraki is really taking the lead in showcasing this project. In fact, he invited President Obasanjo to visit our project, which he did shortly after the inauguration in April. And as a result of this initiative, Governor Taraki now has allocated state funding to go from 3 villages to 30 villages in his state. And also, Obasanjo, I just recently learned, has allocated, I think, 2 billion naira to rolling out a federal program of solar rural electrification. So it looks like our efforts in the northern part of the country have paid off in terms of getting the attention of senior government leaders, including the president himself, in taking these sorts of approaches to solving the energy needs of his people.
Is that a way of the Nigerian government trying to keep control of solar energy so it can continue to sell it? Or is it your impression, Bob, that they're saying, we like these models, we would do this for the village and let the village manage the resource?
I think it's the latter case. They have no way of controlling solar energy. You can't bottle the sun. And I think given the success of our project in the northern part of the country, a country of 120-plus million people, yeah, only, I think, 20% of which have electricity. So it's a huge problem. And the opportunity to replicate our work, expand the model to other states in the country, I think is very appealing to the government if they see how it can be done.
I wonder, Madard, in sort of looking again at the big picture here, you look at Nigeria, it's a country that produces a tremendous amount of oil and gas, and people often make the comment that it's the Nigerian people themselves who really don't share much in the profit from that resource, whether or not in dealing with large corporations, this notion of sharing resources in a slightly more socialist way is just not even talked about.
Well, it's not talked about in any part of the world, including the United States. If you're referring to the notion of the behavior of multinationals in the past going into countries and having the reputation as organized groups of people who are raping, plundering, and pillaging the planet, I think that there is an element of truth to that kind of rapacious behavior all over the place, whether it's government officials or corporations. But one of the things that's going on today with the increased communications that we've got is a level of transparency that makes corruption and the kind of owner's behavior that have existed in the past a lot more difficult to do. That plus the fact that there are actually profits to be made in acting responsibly, that business acting responsibly and governments being responsive and civil society being doing their part, all three working together, the corruption goes away. You know, it's always going to be a part of society,
yeah,
whether it's in the U.S. or Nigeria or Bangladesh or any other place. But you've got a group of people working together for the betterment of society in ways that reward everybody, reward, you know, the people, the entrepreneurs, reward the civil society folks, and help the government folks do their job better as well.
Communication is certainly key to what Medard Gabel is talking about when it comes to reducing transparency and corruption. Communication is a key part of the Solar Electric Light Fund's aim of bringing wireless communications to different parts of the world. But how do you promote the use of technology and innovation and maximize positive outcomes in the world? How do you make it work in places where corporations or national leaders might have other interests? We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Innovation That Matters is our series beginning 2005. Now that we can do anything, what should we do? Bob Freeling is with us. He's Executive Director of the Solar Electric Light Fund, or SELF. And Medard Gabel is also with us. He's Chief Executive Officer of Big Picture Consulting, joining us on the line from Philadelphia. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-423-8255, taking a look at bringing technology to parts of the world that don't have them. Next to Cambridge, and George is on the line. Hi, George.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I usually listen to The Connection on a solar dynamo radio, and I actually paid a couple of people to do different modifications on it so that it could also charge AA batteries. So I've been working with small-scale solar for a while now, and I've been thinking about solar bike lights using button batteries and LEDs and such things as the solar dynamo combination so that you have...
The dynamo is the wind-up, is that right, George?
Right, right. Yeah. But it's a little different than the one that's mostly sold, which is a spring-wound and not a battery.
Mm-hmm.
And these are products, if you have a solar dynamo flashlight radio like I have, which also can recharge batteries, you've got the flashlight, you've got the radio, and you've got the extra set of batteries that everybody says you need in terms of an emergency all in one package. And I've actually tried to see whether this thing is patentable. It is apparently not. I've tried to talk to some product developers, but there's some opportunities for solar products, for appropriate technology products that could be marketable within the United States on a level that would make it affordable to the third world and the developing countries. And
or even functional for people in this world. I mean,
exactly. Uses that we need here that could be solar powered or people powered, using high technology like LED lights or cold cathode.
George, let me, if I can, just turn to Bob Freeling here and ask whether or not the kind of, well, I don't know, you'd refer to them as almost toy solar things, the little panels that you can put on the dashboard of your car to run a fan, the little panels that charge batteries that you can get from Kmart for $9.99. I mean, is that a part of the you know, bringing solar technology to people who don't have it that you consider?
It is indeed, and we have used LED lighting. We're about to install a system in Western Tanzania for Jane Goodall's Gombe Stream Research Center, and LED lighting will figure.
LED lighting different in what way from ordinary lighting then?
Well, LED lights are extremely low power required, and they last a long time. They're expensive. The technology is also maturing quickly, but the advantage of LED lights is you need very small amounts of electric power to run LED lights, and they last almost forever. So we've used LED lighting, and there are other smaller applications, solar lanterns, hybrid solutions where you have a radio that you can wind up or also be solar powered. A larger example of this would be a water pumping system that we are considering for use in Africa and perhaps even in the tsunami affected area of Asia. This is a device called a solar petaflow, and it's a solar-powered pump that can also be used at night just your legs to pedal so that when the sun goes down or if it's raining, you can still pump water without the sun.
You know, there's something that I'd like to hear both of you on for a couple of moments, and that is this notion I think that many of us have in the developed world that whatever technologies are offered to people who don't have electricity or don't have that level of development, that it's a very sort of one-way street designed at you know, over time to bring those people up to the level with the people who are designing them. And I just wonder if in fact, Medard, maybe you can start on that. That's a valid experience. Or if there's something to be said for what the people in northern Nigeria bring to the rest of the world once they have the tools of communication and electrification.
I think it's a great point. We have a lot to learn. You know, we're not dealing with us smart folks selling, you know, intelligent products to dumb folks. We're hopefully, if we're as smart as we think we are, going to learn a huge amount about not just the piece of technology that we think we want to sell to somebody, but how to adapt it, make it work more effectively, more efficiently, by trying to fulfill their needs and in the systems that they're embedded within, the environmental systems, the low amount of energy and infrastructure that they have, we're going to learn how to make products much better for our world. Motorola learned a huge amount about in the early days of pagers, when pagers started going into China, and the Chinese started, much to Motorola's shock, using them in totally different ways than Motorola or what we folks use pagers for. I mean, the Chinese, because they didn't have a telecommunication system, created a little book that went along with the pager that was, you know, an inch thick that had thousands of codes in it that said, you know, when you got this pager message, it meant basically the product is ready, pick it up at 10 a.m. or, you know, honey, I'll be home for dinner at, you know, 7. And they used them in ways that were totally different than anybody had dreamed of ever. The engineers and folks at Motorola had ever dreamed of them being used. That's a fairly trivial example of how we can learn from the base of the pyramid to make our products better, more effective, more efficient.
A chance to hear from you listeners as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bob Freeling, the kind of feedback that you get from places where a self-solar system has been in place for a while, some unintended uses perhaps?
Well, certainly, and we have found throughout our projects that the local technicians that we train and work with are very intelligent and very resourceful. In many cases, they might not have more than a fifth grade education, but they're very intuitive. They're good with their hands, and they often come up with creative, innovative solutions that we would never think of. And we've seen that time and time again. In terms of application, I just was online with our partner down in the Amazon asking him about examples in which the communications that they have in place now, the wireless internet access, has been used in ways to improve health or education. And he provided a very dramatic example in which a young boy had accidentally shot himself in the head. And the bullet was lodged in the skull. And Chris Clark, who's the co-founder of the Amazon Association down there in Brazil, got online with some medical experts, and they walked him through the process of removing the bullet from this boy's skull. And it was very successful, and a life was saved.
Medard, what would you say to people, though, who are feeling a little bit suspicious about how far, how fast you can go, people thinking that, oh, my God, you know, what would happen if you dropped 10 laptop computers and wireless internet access in a part of the world that's never really had television? And is that moving too quickly?
Well, just to be ornery or insulting, I would say that that question, if they were asking it, was probably a product of an elitist notion. I think if you drop those computers or any technology, if it is viable and meets real needs of the human beings that are living in those regions, it'll get used. And if it doesn't, it will become book stops or door stops. It's up to the people who live there. I mean, that's what, when we started off the conversation with Bob in the very beginning, he talked about a local needs assessment. And if your work is based on what the people in the regions really want, not what we think they want, but what's really happening in their village and meeting real needs, then it's going to get used. And we don't have to worry about trespassing, violating the sensibilities, their culture. They're going to use what is going to be important to them.
1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join us. We're going next to Francistown, New Hampshire. Ray's joining us. Hi, Ray.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I spent quite a few years in the mid-70s installing solar electric systems in Ivory Coast, in Upper Volta then, and in Niger.
Mm-hmm.
And they were mainly installed for refrigeration, as you had mentioned, irrigation, and educational television. But one of the unintended uses was in the evening, we'd see a faint blue glow from the local school where the educational TV was housed, and the locals were watching television from the capital, French movies and,
right.
and sitcoms and that sort of thing. And I'm not sure they knew what was going on, but they were enormously entertained.
Who was paying for the work at the time when you were doing it, Ray? Was it the sort of NGO enterprise that Bob's involved with, or was it more government related?
It was government, although I was working for one of these large multinationals that you've mentioned, and a large oil company that owned a company that was in Massachusetts, and we produced the solar systems and mainly for electrification of oil platforms, but also for this particular type of application.
So were you there when the panels connected to the battery and the batteries connected to the wires and the television or the radio goes on for the first time?
Yes, I actually was installing most of these systems myself.
Must be very cool to actually see how people respond to that for the first time, say, in their own homes or in their own neighborhood school.
It was amazing to see. It was a turnout for the village, and a lot of the local officials would come in, and it was quite a big event.
Bob Freeling, I would imagine you have some experience watching the lights come on for the first time in the evening in a place that's never had man-made light in it.
I have, Dick. In fact, my first exposure to this business was in western China in Gansu province back in 1994, where I traveled to remote villages that were only reachable by foot. And I had the privilege of installing systems and getting to see families flip a switch and have electric light come on and television for the first time in their lives. And as Ray mentioned, the whole village would gather around, mm-hmm. and it was a very joyous occasion for them and for me.
I'm wondering if it also has something to do, Ray, maybe you have experience with this in the Côte d'Ivoire area, but if it has anything to do with trying to bring some of the services that people would normally have to go to the city to use, that if you take power to the smaller towns and villages, that not, you know, the people aren't necessarily going to pack up and head for the slums of the closest large city.
Well, I think in my experience, especially up in near Niamey in Niger, the government was trying to attract people to the area and was setting up villages and setting up the water facilities to attract some of the local more nomadic people to be more settled and to supply some agriculture and some livestock to the local city.
Brings me back, Medard Gabel, to what we were talking about earlier in the program and the way that it needs to be explained to people, this whole idea of for example, stopping the urbanization of the developing world. I spent time in India, so I'm familiar with what happened in Bombay and Delhi and areas where everybody simply went to the large cities searching for power. That's a major selling point of the sort of thing that Bob's doing.
Well, one of the things that's going on is people are migrating out of the rural areas to the urban because that's where the jobs are, that's where you can get ahead, A, and B, because the lack of basic services in the rural areas. But if you can harness some of the forces that we're talking about here and provide the basic services to the rural areas so that it's not a no-brainer to leave home in a rural area that's impoverished to go to a crowded city, but at least the chances are better there, at least the way you're looking at it,
mm-hmm.
We're going to do a huge service for the entire planet if we can get some of those 2 billion people on the planet who are primarily in the rural areas who have never switched on a light switch or have made a phone call, if we can get them the services that will diminish the gap between the urban area and the rural areas.
And that's a case that needs to be made to Western politicians, Bob, I guess, that everybody has some self-interest in this.
That's right, Dick. It's a small world. It's all interconnected, and nobody is unaffected by what happens in remote parts of the world. And as Medard so beautifully pointed out, bringing power and communication access to rural villages will help stem the flow of urban migration, which is such a large problem that we're facing now, and provide a world that which is more equitable and more just. And it has profound implications for the entire planet, because we need to work towards a world which works for everybody. And you see the implications of poverty and degradation spilling over and affecting us here in the developed world. So we need to bring these solutions as quickly as possible to the 2 billion people that are without power, without communications.
And I'd like to point out that's not charity. That's not us do-gooders, providing something for those who don't have much. It's really self-interest. Wealth is not a function of just how much money you have. It's where you've got it. If you've got, $10 billion of gold bullion, but you happen to be on the Titanic, you're just going to sink faster. And so if we're in a safe, secure world where everybody's better off, even the wealthiest of us folks are going to be in a world that is infinitely richer, because where we've got our money is much better.
Bob, on an earlier program, someone made the observation that the Chinese description of crisis is a combination of the words danger and opportunity. And with so much attention, so many people's minds on the cleanup after the tsunami in Southeast and South Asia, I'm wondering if there is opportunity there to bring these kinds of projects, whether they're water purification or solar electric, to the villages, because they are, in effect, starting from scratch.
Well, as a matter of fact, I was on the phone just this morning with friends and colleagues in both Sri Lanka and in India, and there is a very dire need to provide, first and foremost, clean water, because the risk of people dying from an outbreak of cholera or typhoid is very big, and so to the extent that we can use solar energy to provide clean water solutions, which is very doable, mm-hmm. and provide vaccine refrigeration to store badly needed vaccines in these affected areas, lighting for health clinics and telecommunications. Even power for orphanages, which are springing up as we speak. We do have an opportunity and a need to bring these innovative solutions to this part of the world, which is crying out for our help.
And I should mention again that if you go to our website at theconnection.org, you can look at a gallery of projects itself is already involved in, and a link to the Solar Electric Light Fund website. Also, thanks today to the Institute Without Boundaries, the creators of the Massive Change book and exhibit and website, for help with research on today's program. And a chance to say thanks to Bob Freeling for being with us. Nice to have you, Bob.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Bob is Executive Director of the Solar Electric Light Fund. And Medard Gabel, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you.
Medard is Chief Executive Officer of Big Picture Consulting. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.